every minute of every day almost is a constant negotiation between what you want to get, and the community, the collective, the other person. And it's that constant balance and negotiation between yourself and society, and between difference, but also sharing a value together. And in a way, anarchism's just being honest in a way about some, that this is sort of how we act in the world, that there, it is full of contradictions. And in a way, what anarchism tries to do is say, let's just make them transparent and try our damnedest to make the best possible balancing act between the two, knowing that it's going to be a constant negotiation between self and community again and again and again. Whereas other political philosophies either say, oh no, it's all about the individual, or it's all about the community, and we're going to try to brush aside those contradictions and pretend it can be all about the community, or brush aside that and pretend that it's just about the individual. And I think that's detrimental to, in a sense, impose something that doesn't exist in the world, impose a binary that doesn't exist, instead of trying to see the complexities of human life. So anarchism is constantly dynamic and evolving and changing and open, which on the other hand can be difficult to understand what anarchism is about. Okay, so it starts in the 19th century. It is a European phenomena primarily, where it starts, at least who theorizes about it and who starts practicing it, who starts organizing it. This is in Europe where it becomes a distinct political philosophy. So it does have baggage from, in a sense, a Eurocentric viewpoint. But on the other hand, anarchists love to travel even then. So if you look back at classical anarchists, they're like running around the world, and they're dropping books off, and they're dropping leaflets off. And the reason I've been in Amsterdam is my partner's working on a dissertation. But I've been in this wonderful archive. This is one of the largest anarchist archives in the world, and anyone can walk in. You don't need credentials. Hi, I'd like so-and-so's papers. Give me the note card. You get to read, you know, people's laundry lists from 1898, and their love letters and blah, whatever you want to read. But what's amazing about it, you look at these pamphlets, and you're going, God, wow, there really is this, it's profoundly moving to see both how far we've come, and also that we're not that different in a way either. So you have all these great little zines and pictures and people, not, they didn't call them zines then, but they're doing the same goddamn thing we're doing. And so they're running around to different places, and likewise, other people are too. So there's a really, I want to point out that even though it's a European-based, originally political philosophy, and pretty much who I'm going to talk about are people that schools that developed in Europe. A lot of new thought is that things, just because they start one place, they don't stay there, especially when you have political people that move around a lot. And there's some amazing books coming out now on sort of showing how anarchism floats around the world in ways people didn't understand before. So there's a fantastic book on Chinese anarchism, for instance, point to one. And Chinese anarchism, but it's by actually a Marxist historian of Maoism and Chinese communism. He's very sympathetic to anarchism. And he talks about how Chinese intellectuals and political people came to Europe to study and got to be friends with all these anarchists in Paris and London, and they loved what they were saying, and so they brought back anarchist works to China in the late 19th century, and they translated them to Chinese, but then they also started writing their own stuff. And they started commenting and criticizing what the Europeans had read. They're like, well, you know, this critique doesn't make sense in China. The absence of domination would look really different in China, and here's how we would understand that to look. Again, anarchism might be a European phenomenon originally, but more and more we'll see that it floats around and changes and ends up becoming something very different. So anarchism moves to China, Japan, Latin America, the Mediterranean, to America, all sorts of places, because anarchists travel and talk and are totally interested in just dropping literature everywhere and that fusion. But emerging in Europe, the reason I point to that is it emerged really as a specific reaction to a few things. One was the Enlightenment. Anarchism was coming out of Enlightenment philosophy, and without going too much into the Enlightenment, what that was a whole movement about, and what was better parts of the Enlightenment, because there's bad parts too, was that the Enlightenment said sort of three things. It was an Enlightenment philosophy that started a couple hundred years before anarchism became a political philosophy. One is that humans have the capacity to reason. Kind of like, duh, but at that time that was very revolutionary. Because before that people were told, you don't reason, you do what God tells you to do, or you do what the king tells you to do. So suddenly everyone had the capacity to think. Really radical idea. We don't understand how radical that is, but that is a radical idea. The second one is, well, if we all have the ability to reason, we have the ability to act. Again, a really radical idea. You didn't act when you lived under, you know, an all-powerful king or church and state. You didn't act, you just lived or survived. Okay, we can reason, we can act, and if we can act, you know, we can actually act to do some good things if we want to. We can actually try to, I hate to use the word progress because it sounds linear, so I won't, innovate. We can actually create a good world if we want to. Now, doesn't mean we're going to, but we can. And that, again, was a really, people didn't really understand themselves that way. They sort of, I was born into, you know, living in this village as a serf or a slave or this or that, and I didn't really have the capacity to think or to act, and you kind of lived out your whole life that way. Really radical idea. So suddenly what happens is all these people take that seriously. Oh, wow, wow, wow. And suddenly you have a whole host of revolutions breaking out in Europe. A direct result of philosophy. So I want to say philosophy is important because it can cause social movements to happen, and social movements use philosophy, vice versa. So you have a whole revolutionary era in Europe starting in 1789, going probably to 1870s, moves on to Mexico, Haiti, a whole bunch of other places, U.S., before it was the U.S., and again, we can critique revolutions as being good and bad. There was always losers, and those losers should have been maybe the people that were being liberated but weren't, as a host of these revolutions ultimately became really horrendous, bloodthirsty, all sorts of bad ramifications, as we could find out from our own American Revolution, and although I like parts of the American Revolution. But so what this suggests is people are living in a time period when revolution is happening pretty much every 10 or 20 years or 15 years. So what that shows people is not only can we think and act and innovate, but we can actually make tangible change. We can actually transform the world, because they did transform the world. Again, not as revolutionary as we would understand it, but suddenly, instead of, you know, a king that could just arbitrarily do whatever the hell they wanted, you actually had parliaments or representative democracy, people you could influence, you could engage in politics. Now, say, oh, that's, personally, I would say, oh, that's no innovation at all. In a sense, that's part of our domination now more than ever. But at the time, that was really revolutionary, that people could engage in shaping their own society. So anarchism emerges in this context of revolutionary possibility, kings falling, rise of nation states, which, as anarchists saw it, created a new forms of centralization that kings hadn't brought about. So responding to switch from kings to nation states. And you also have the rise of liberalism in a sort of hyper sense of individualism. So new forms of centralization, new forms of individualism, and other people thinking they can be revolutionary and act. At the same time, coincidentally, you have all these things converging together, because I don't think there's ever one cause. You have the Industrial Revolution starting, capitalism really moving into how we understand capitalism more enforced than it had been before that. Factories are created, people are pushed off, you know, village life, off farms, off subsistence economies into crowded cities, you know, become wage slave instead of subsistence farmer slaves, because I don't romanticize subsistence farming either. So what happens at this time period is there's a simultaneous whole new sense of human immiseration or suffering. People have to break with their families, break with their ties, their traditions, often live in places that are much more unhealthy and dangerous. You know, rats, plagues, blah, 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 all the things, factories that were really unsafe. Not that factories are particularly safe right now. But at the same time, there's still a simultaneous sense of freedom. For instance, some of the things in traditional village life, as most of us would probably guess, were pretty damned constrictive for anyone that didn't understand themselves within that narrow, 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 narrow tradition, sexually, gender-wise, etc., all host of other things. So there's this great time of both horrible new transformations in society and unbelievable sense of possibility, and you have Karl Marx, who every anarchist should read Karl Marx. And in a sense, anarchism comes out of, is totally indebted to, just as every socialist and communist is to Marx. There's a phrase that all anarchists are socialists, but not all socialists are anarchists. Can I repeat that again? All anarchists are socialists, meaning they all, in a sense, share the critique of capitalism that comes out of Marx, but all socialists aren't anarchists, meaning a lot of socialists don't care about the critique of states or critique of domination that anarchism does. But I understand communism, socialism, and anarchism all emerging out of Marx's ideas and the movement that he was a part of. It wasn't just him. So he calls the great transformation at this time, as we're all familiar with, he comes up with this phrase, capital. It's really his term to describe the new economic system. We know that as capitalism, he calls it capital. Read his book. Suggest reading Capital. If there's one book, his critique of capitalism, if anything, we need to critique capitalism more than ever. The critique of capitalism has not lost its resonance. That is, in a sense, the prime, I mean, if you get, that's what Marx is able to do. And his, obviously, a lot of his things are wrong, et cetera, but everyone that writes about capitalism, everyone that critiques capitalism either disagrees with Marx, refers to Marx, agrees with parts. He really is the, in a sense, the basis of all forms of critique of capitalism, even if you don't like him. So what's important about Marx is he foresaw, for the first time, how capitalism as a system would spread, that it was in a sense like a cancer or something that grows, that will keep becoming larger and larger and larger, that it has to grow in order to still be a system. It is a dynamic system that cannot rely on stability. It has to keep growing. It has to, in a sense, be exactly what the hell's happening with capitalism now. It has to be flexible, constantly changing, constantly renewing itself. And that the only way to get rid of capitalism was that it would not negotiate things with another social system, that you had to get rid of it if you wanted to come to a new form of social organization. So you have socialists, communists, anarchists who want a different kind of social organization coming to the conclusion you can't negotiate with capital for that new form of social organization. You have to dismantle the one in order to get another. Now what's important about Marx to me is not as an economist, but and if you read Marx, I think, read Capital or some of his other works, I think he's fairly clear about this, that he saw capitalism not so much as an economic way of provisioning the world, although he certainly describes that, but as a way of structuring social relationships or social organization. It does this through things like production and distribution and its economic mechanisms, and maybe he was way too economistic, which many people might argue, but he really saw capitalism largely as a system of social organization that was fundamentally premised upon exploitation or domination. You cannot have a nicer capitalism or a smaller capitalism or a little bit of capitalism, because at its core, it's intimately about a form of social organization of domination and exploitation. So if you're for the absence of domination, the conclusion is capitalism is not going to be compatible with that. And how Marx talked about this was that if you read Capital, he starts off by talking about at the very beginning how what capital does is it takes this thing, this little thing that I can use to write things up on the board. And it might be useful right now if I'm writing something, but capitalism doesn't care whether I can use this chalk or not. Capitalism cares whether I can turn this thing into a commodity. Instead of something that's useful and I can give to you and we can share and it serves something, this thing suddenly is only valuable, even if it's useful, it doesn't really matter. It's only valuable if you will give me money for it and then you can get more money for it and then someone else can get more money for it. But that isn't really the heart of capitalism, because what happens is this relationship, this hidden buyer-sell relationship, is really an instrumental way of looking at the world. This thing is only as good, even if I can actually use it, it's only as good as what I can get for it from someone else. So it creates every relationship, a social relationship, starts becoming structured around instrumental view of the world, and instrumental in terms of exploitation being at the heart of that. And what happens over time is it isn't just this, it's this, it's the trees outside, it's the buildings, it's everything we can think of becomes increasingly commodified, but that's a whole other discussion. So, and that's what Marx foresaw, is that everything would suddenly be turned, our wages, our labor, our love, everything would be turned into commodity. So everything would start following this logic of instrumentality, and the real problem with that is it alienates us from a world of our own making. We've actually created this chalk, this building, ourselves, you know, everything we see in the world, created, not created completely, obviously, I can't be whatever I want to be. But in a sense, what this does is it creates a world of things that seem to control us, when in fact we're the ones that came up with this form of social organization in the first place. So it makes a system of social organization that controls us instead of we controlling it. And that's the core of capitalism. And so anarchists, Marxists, and socialists at this time were all like, okay, this is a problem. So you end up with what all socialists share, before I move into anarchism. You end up with everyone who's a socialist being an anti-capitalist. Even today, that's what everyone shares. Out of this comes notions of liberation, justice, solidarity, emphasis on community, which is communism, or socialism, a real strong emphasis on community, to counterpose that to the individualism of capitalism and liberalism. Out of Marxism and others, you end up with this idea of classless society, and so you have to have a class struggle, because at that point they saw the heart of exploitation being in the production of these little things in factories, which isn't really true anymore. We're commodified, and our leisure time is commodified. How I choose to even recreate now is already sort of predetermined, which wasn't true in the time of Marx's writing. And ultimately, an end to private property. Okay, so you have Marx, and you have socialists, and you have communists, and they're all coming up, okay, we want a communal justice, anti-capitalist, but then you have the reason anarchism emerges sort of out of socialism, in a sense everyone was socialist, is that anarchism said, hey, or anarchists, what about that thing out there called the state? It isn't just this thing that's becoming commodified in the sphere of economics, But there's this other thing that's rising up at the same time, not just the Industrial Revolution, but there's the rise of nation states. And isn't that a problem, too? Aren't states a new form of domination exploitation inherently? Isn't there some power relationships behind that? So these socialists saw the state basically as equally complicit as capital in structuring our social relationships, equally complicit in enslaving us. And these people said you can't use, in a sense, you can't use the state as a way to get rid of capitalism. And this ends up all sorts of other historical reasons, but a big split where you end up having anarchism emerging is not just anti-capitalist, but against states as well. This lingers on as a fairly big distinction between people who understand themselves as communists and socialists and people that understand themselves as anarchists. Still try to focus on the sense of the state as well. Now at this time, just before I go into some of the schools of thought, a third great critique of anarchism besides capitalism and the state was the church, because they just come out of this era of the dominance of churches. If you look around any community, especially I live in New England, so every community, the middle of town, what's there? A church. Church was extremely important in people's lives, another form of domination at the time. So you often get the phrase, no gods, no masters, from anarchists at that time period, and they literally did. They were critiquing the church at that time. That phrase might not be as valuable now. Okay, now 19th century anarchism, in hindsight, these are sort of the three great things anarchism focused on at the time. Clearly that ignores all sorts of forms of domination. Again, I pointed to, the woman question, or gender, or sexuality, or race, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Many anarchists were actually extremely anti-Semitic, for instance, or a racist, or just didn't even deal with those things. Homophobic. Some anarchists weren't, a lot of them were. So, okay, clearly they didn't have their absence of domination only applied to specific things. So in other words, again, we need to keep in mind that 19th and 20th century, while it may be the beginnings, is certainly far, far, far from the end of what anarchism might want to look like. And I point to Marx because really I think we still need to maintain this critique of capitalism, and I think anarchists need to, there's a lot of scholarship where Marxists go back and reevaluate the critique of capitalism through Marx, and I think anarchists need to rethink the critique of capitalism, and they don't often do that, so that's why I point to Marx. Now I just kind of want to go through like six or eight different sort of schools of anarchist thought to sort of give you a sense in the 19th century of the different ways anarchists tried to understand the world, and then I'll try to wrap up by some of the shared things today that I think sort of most anarchists would probably understand themselves to share, and then we could stop. And again, there are plenty of other sort of schools. I hate to even call them schools, but they're sort of different tendencies, maybe. One is philosophical anarchism. This is a guy named William Godwin, who actually did not consider himself an anarchist, writes a book called An Enquiry Concerning Political Justice. But he's the first political philosopher in the time period of the rise of the nation state to actually articulate an anti-statist philosophy of politics. So he writes this huge 800-page book. If you have a chance to read sections of it, it's a fantastic book. It's one of the most rigorous pieces by someone who really should be included within anarchism, where he basically talks about why the state is unnatural, artificial, and no way to run social organization or political organization. Extremely libertarian understanding of the state, very anti-statist, but no one's really, he has a wonderful political philosophy in terms of the state, and extremely liberatory in terms of education, marriage, etc. And in fact, the way his sort of notions of how to get to the anti-statist society were actually not as liberatory as his sort of cultural ideas. He didn't believe in marriage, although he ends up marrying Wollstonecraft, who's one of the major feminists of the time, because she wanted to marry, ironically. She dies in childbirth. Mary Shelley is their daughter. Shelley's partner or husband, I'm not sure if they were married. I don't think they actually did, because Shelley had a wife already. They didn't marry, but she took his last name. But he's basically considered an anarchist poet, and she writes Frankenstein, which is completely indebted to her father's philosophy and other the milieu she was hanging in. So it's all this fermentation, but very philosophical. And the reason I say this is a school is he thought a lot about the world, but he didn't change it, William Godwin. And in fact, his whole philosophy of how you create social change was through education. You can't force people to be free, which I agree with, but his idea was it's about educating to sort of everyone's on the same page, and then suddenly we'll be in a better society, potentially. But he also thought that people like him should be at the forefront of doing the educational work, because he was quite intelligent, which sort of very elitist sort of notions to his political philosophy as well. But it's important to think about the world, but obviously it's important to change it too. So that's one school, sort of thinking about what an anti-statist society would look like. Is this actually helpful? I put their dates, or should I forget it because it takes them? And I'm not putting the names of their books because I'll be here all day writing, and unfortunately. So again, Pierre Joseph Proudhon, who I mentioned, he wrote the book What is Property? They all wrote many books, but I'm only kind of pointing to the key works if you want to read. I really suggest people go back and read like key works by prominent anarchists of the past to know what the hell they're saying. You find out you know, all sorts of interesting things that you didn't know, and there's anthologies of their work or separate pieces. So he comes up with this idea that states and governments over time will disappear, and that individuals will relate to each other through mutual economic contracts. He was extremely economistically oriented, good friends with Marx. They write with each other, and then they have a break, and then they write against each other, and they write books that have the exact same title where they reverse them, where they're both critiquing each other. The Poverty of Philosophy and the Philosophy of Poverty, and the critiques of each other, and I'm too think which one wrote which one right now, but they end up not liking each other. But he's still extremely economistic because he comes out of really close ties to, I mean, all these people knew each other at the time, like today where we all know each other, and creates a lot more fermentation when you know each other and having discussions. So he believed mutual economic contracts. He basically supported private property, but only in the sense when he says, what is property? Property is theft. He understands property to be large-scale things, means of production, land, factories. He doesn't understand it to be my piece of paper or my little sewing machine or my little oven to bake bread or things like that. He thinks that each of us should have a little bit of those things to be able to make a little bit of things to be able to relate to each other and exchange through mutual contracts those things. Because if you don't have a little bit of something, then you're at the mercy of everybody else. If you don't have enough to take care of yourself, you're potentially, I could say, oh, I'm not giving you any food today. And then, you know, you're going to have to do what I say. So he sort of thought you needed some possessions in order to provide for yourself, but not too much. Now that's the problem with Proudhon. How do you stop someone once they have a little bread oven from making some bread that people like? And then people really like the bread, so they buy another bread oven. And then they get 10 bread ovens, and then they get a bread oven factory. And so he didn't really work that out. So his small-scale capitalism, he really missed, much as he was friends with Marx, he missed Marx's point that you can't have a little bit of exploitation through the relationships of capitalist production. So I find Proudhon not so interesting, but good to read if you want to kind of see the history of anarchism. His whole thing was that people would agree to these sort of mutual contracts between each other because ultimately we'd all be seeking the same thing, a just and good society, and we'd all try to act that way. Again, kind of a naive view. It's also largely based on contract. But the main thing that I think is interesting to take from him is a sense of mutuality or mutualism. How could we mutually decide, you know, in ways to provision ourselves or take care of each other that would be based on us having conversations back and forth? But again, that's probably about all you might want to take from him. Not one of the best. He's actually in, there's an anthology called No Gods, No Masters on anarchism, largely sort of anarcho-syndicalist anarchism. He's in there with several pieces as an interesting footnote. It's for sale on AK Table. I just saw it. You don't have to buy it from AK. But I think they might publish it. in that, the pieces in there, three or four pieces, I'm pretty sure it's in there, where he actually talks about different times where he voted or not voted, if for those of you that are interested in that debate among anarchists, because he voted in all sorts of different elections, and then he didn't vote for a while and stuff, so he went back and forth. He was very dynamic, which I think was good, actually. Max Stirner, if you want a fun and wild and relatively short read, he wrote one book called The Ego and His Own, which is an English translation. It's different in German, which is what he wrote in, but there is an English translation, The Ego and His Own. And he was really responding to the extreme sense of individualism created under capitalism and nation states. I'd almost call him not an anarchist and would probably see him more as a nihilist because he ultimately kind of was against everything, sort of. But I'd still fit him within the really extreme version of individualist anarchism without quite going far past that because he really did understand that we had to do these things socially together, although finding that kernel of sociality in there is extremely difficult. This book is really wild because what he basically talks about is the sovereignty of the individual. The individual sovereignty, meaning I get to control, make decisions about myself. That each individual, we all should just admit, all right, we've all got egos, we all have self-interest, we all want what's best for ourselves. If we were just honest about that, there wouldn't be problems. If we came at each other and said, listen, I want to get this out of you, I want to have sex tonight, I want to get... have blah, 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 I want to make some money, I want to, you know, do this because it'll make me feel good, whatever it is, that's okay, suddenly, because it's on the table. And then what you do is you get these egos together and they negotiate with each other. And so what he proposes is a union of egos. In a sense, we confederate with each other as open and honest egos. And when I don't get what I want from you, like I want you to, you know, bake me bread again. Okay, use bread. I want you to break me bread tonight. I come, oh, can you have an oven? Can you break me bread tonight? And you're like, I don't feel like it tonight. The union of ego dissolves instantly. So it's this temporary thing that comes and goes. But what's interesting about him is he has a rigorous, rigorous critique of things that are hidden. Why do we need to hide our self-interest? If we just were honest about what we want, really what we're all seeking, he thought, is the same thing. Pleasure, enjoyment of life, comfort, things I was pointing to earlier. And if we're just all honest about that and we kind of continually try to shatter anything that we pretend isn't about that, that we'll be able to actually move towards sort of social revolution. A really difficult position, I think, but intriguing to read. So he has this rigorous critique of any concepts that dominate us. He critiques hate, but love. He critiques, you know, taking, but he critiques giving. Anything you can possibly imagine, you go, but love, how could you not like that? You know, how could you not like doing something nice for someone? Because he critiques, like, oh, when you do something, let's say you decide you'll take care of your sick parent for a week. He's like, oh, bullshit, you're only taking care of them because it makes you feel good. And then you can go tell all your friends, oh, I spent the last week taking care of my mother. She's really sick. Wasn't that nice of me? He's like, why don't you just admit that's why you're doing it? Now, you may, and so it's, you're like, but hey, maybe I really do love my mother. You know, so but in a way, he makes you think about that we need to continually look at every concept that we think about and understand how that concept might be dominating us. So that's what he's interesting for, too. How do concepts, even kind of neutral seeming ones, seem like they control us? So it's a really wild book to read. Although I shouldn't recommend it too highly because I never know if you'll come in. Union of Egoists. Mikhail Bakunin is really well known for The Urge to Destroy is a Creative Urge. Yeah, that's his, like, what everyone remembers him for. He wrote a fantastic book. He wrote many books, but one fantastic book is called Statism and Anarchy. I totally adored reading it when I read it a couple years ago. Again, I read parts of it, but I read it again. I was like, whoa, it's a fantastic, fantastic critique of the state. He's also viciously, viciously in there anti-Semitic. He hates Germans. He hates Marx, especially because Marx is Jewish and German. He hates everyone. So it's also like this book full of, like, this person's this, and all Germans are this, and all this or that, but he also has a fantastic critique of the state. Now, what he thought that we should do was collectivize, again, very economistic, again, friends with Marx. He's the one that actually had the huge, huge falling out with Marx, if you want to read the history of anarchism, where anarchism and Marxism break forever and can never reconcile, in a sense, with Bakunin. Bakunin, there's a bunch of power plays, and Marx kicks Bakunin out of a meeting that Bakunin isn't allowed to come to in the Netherlands when all the socialists are meeting. So what he says, very economistically, is that we need to collectivize the means of production. And then we need to redistribute things based on who works. Now, most of us who understand ourselves to be anarchists are going, hey, that's kind of weird. Okay, what if you don't want to work, or what if people work a different amount? But the main point is that he thought that we need to collectivize how we produce things in society. Not necessarily how we bake a cake, if it's tiny, but how we make, you know, large-scale things, or things that involve agriculture, or anything that any kind of things that we produce, things that people need on a regular basis. What's really beautiful about Bakunin, before I move on to someone else, because this whole notion of collectivism, he strongly, strongly believes that you can't have individual freedom without social freedom, and you can't have social freedom without individual freedom. And again in his writings, he really emphasizes that more than some other anarchists, about how they're completely intimately bound up with each other. How can you know yourself and be individuated without a strong sense of community and connection and sociability? And how can you be social if you don't have any personality or sense of yourself? He's really good on that question. Anarcho-communism, and this is sort of where I place myself, although I'm not a Kropotkinite, but I like this tradition. Although it looks really different than it did, that's why I'm not in this 19th century sense. Kropotkin wrote a huge amount. Mutual Aid or The Conquest of Bread might be two good ones to look at. He too thought that we had to have common ownership of the means of production, just like Bakunin. But what's really different about him, instead of based on work to get things, he thought it should be based on need, and that people have different needs. So you have a real shift between these two of how the communism and the collectivism happens. But again, in terms of common ownership of property, production, housing, premised on what you need. So we might not all have the same kind of house, for instance. He really emphasized social solidarity and cooperation, this phrase mutual aid. It's what he's really well known for, a phrase that almost all anarchists still use. He was responding to Darwin's ideas that Darwin said there's competition and cooperation in nature, but competition tends to work more to perpetuate species. And Kropotkin said, yep, I agree, there's competition and cooperation in nature. They both thought they were both things. But it's really when species, organisms cooperate or have mutual aid that they do better. So it's just, they're looking at the same phenomena of evolution or innovation and seeing different sort of sides of it. And he was also a scientist and geographer. Really lovable guy to read his writings. And he has a positive concept of freedom as both moral development and self-development within a community again. And the reason I like this combination broadly as to how to understand anarchism is that it's about anarchism politically, an absence of social domination and social forms of organization that are self-managed, self-governed, self-controlled, etc. But it doesn't forget the roots of anarchism, the socialist, that we need to own more things collectively, cooperatively, mutualistically. So it really combines this phrase, whether Kropotkin embodies it completely, because he doesn't, it combines sort of the best of what came out of the left. These aren't in any particular order. Anarcho-feminism is Emma Goldman, who probably everybody knows, who wasn't all that theoretical, but and never supposedly said, if I can't dance, I don't want to be part of a revolution I can't dance to. No one has ever found that phrase in any of her papers, but yet she said it. She did a lot of work around aesthetic theory and arts and stuff, so that gets attributed to her. And she was interested in aesthetics, theatrics, and all sorts of things, but never, no one's actually ever found that phrase yet, the historians that look at her. But what I think is important about her is not just the feminism part of it so much, but she was really interested in, and this was much broader than just feminism, is the personal and psychological dimensions of domination. And as I said before, anarchism was looking at capitalism, the state, and the church. And she said, hey, okay, there's a personal feeling, there's personal life, and there's also how we just feel under capitalism, how we feel under the state, and those are equally important. And how aesthetically we approach the world. She was very interested in culture and aesthetics and how that comes. So added those dimensions to anarchism at a time when other people weren't talking about that. She did bring what we understand as sort of traditional feminist ideas into anarchism, which obviously need to be gone way beyond today with all sorts of new notions beyond sort of gender binaries and all. But at the time, you know, she really brought in ideas of what does it mean to love that's mutualistic, voluntarily, et cetera, et cetera. What is marriage? She wrote about things that at that time seemed to concern females. But again, I'd like to stress that, you know, I hate to sort of say, well, it's, you know, it isn't just about feminism. She's really broadening the approach of anarchism to dimensions outside of what other anarchists had talked about at the time. Anarcho-syndicalism. Whoops, and you can't read that. And this is Rudolf Rocker. Again, there's lots of people that think under all these ideas. I'm just kind of picking one that is well-known and easy to find their works. He didn't die that long ago. He was staunchly against marriage. As a footnote, he and his partner, long-term partner, came over on the boat from Europe. They had been exiled. A lot of these anarchists were kicked out of countries repetitively, and he was coming to the United States to find shelter, and they'd gone on this long, I don't know, God knows how long a boat ride took to the United States, months or weeks or something. He gets there, and they go, they asked him something like, I think they knew he was political, or they asked him some question that you think would have gotten him kicked out, and they don't care about that, but then they asked if they're married, and they're like, no. And they're like, well, you need to marry to stay here, and they refused, and they got back on the boat and went all the way back. I think years later, they actually did get married. Maybe they should have done it then. So anarcho-syndicalism, slightly different than some of these other things, looks to economics. The 19th century anarchists, I really want to emphasize, unlike today, were highly, highly focused on the economy and capitalism, because capitalism seemed to sort of have appeared. And now it's sort of like, oh, we've always lived under capitalism, haven't we? So anarchists have moved away. I think it's still completely important. So, but at that time, they were often focused on the economic. So they were interested in anarcho-syndicalists, and syndicalism just means union. It's a French word. Syndicals means unions. They were interested in revolutionary or militant trade unions. Very directly democratic ones, often controlled by the workers. They were against large-scale sort of parties, unions, in the traditional sense we think of them, hierarchical ones. And they wanted to basically overthrow capitalism via general strikes. They would then replace economics, forms of provisioning, with non-statist federated union producer groups. So workers' organizations, in a sense, would replace statecraft and capitalism afterward. And what's interesting about them is they really, more than any other anarchist, often talked about carving out the new world and the shell of the old, right now starting, you know, worker-owned co-ops and worker-owned unions and trying to now do the world you want to. I mean, all anarchists have done that, but they were prominent in that. They really looked to sort of trade, militant, decentralized trade unionism or militant trade action, worker action. Real emphasis on the workplace even today. Insurrectionary or propagandist kind of anarchism. And Malatesta, who I mentioned earlier, again, not a real like theoretician, but like a brilliant writer. And totally, if you're depressed, read Malatesta. He's very uplifting and full of hope. He thought that people needed to be stimulated to think for themselves, so he thought that meant propaganda. He talked about educating for freedom. But it wasn't about you telling people what to think, it's stimulating people to think for themselves. So the other way he thought you'd do that was through direct action. But unlike the syndicalists who thought it was a general strike where everyone went on strike, he said, why the hell are we shutting down the factories and the farms? The point is to take them over and keep them running, but run them the way we think they should be run. So he was against the general strike, but was for taking things over and running them the way we thought they should be run, which is exactly what direct action is supposed to be, as opposed to a form of public pressure, which it often is now, is like we just don't want the trade ministers to meet, or we just, direct action traditionally meant taking something over and doing it the way you think it should be done in a decentralized, directly democratic, taking the action directly yourselves. That's really different than simply stopping trade ministers from meeting, which isn't direct action. It's really good, but it's not direct action in the way that anarchists have understood it. He wanted to catalyze, the reason he was insurrectionary is he wanted to catalyze the desire for revolution via targeted acts of dramatic outbursts. And suddenly someone would do something in the middle of a town, you know, set a dumpster on fire, do something, and suddenly everyone would go, whoa, yes, you're right, we do want social revolution, and everyone else would come running in the streets. So he and a few group of people went around from town to town to town doing all sorts of these like wild actions. Never really happened that like everybody ran out of their houses. Oh yeah, you're right, we forgot, we want revolution today. But I mean, you do that enough times, sometimes like Seattle, it works. So the notion is that sometimes people needed to be catalyzed, not just through thought, but also through action, and people willing to do actions. I mean, if you look at the history of him and other people he's involved with, they did all sorts of really dumb things, just running around causing trouble everywhere for... But at the same time, so they also get the label of being really violent, because a lot of what they did were sort of spectacular acts, which didn't necessarily hurt anybody, but, you know, looked like they could or had the potential to. But his point, he's really beautiful on this. He says, anarchists are the most nonviolent people you could ever hope to find, because anarchists believe in a form of social organization without domination, without hierarchy, without oppression, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they live in the reality of an extremely violent society that has a monopoly on violence, and at times we'll be forced to defend ourselves, and we'll be forced to do things that are so far removed from who we are. But that's not anywhere near what we envision for a world. Now, again, we could critique whether that's, you know, problematic or not, or whether that's right or not, but it's really one of the nicer ways of explaining anarchism's relation to militancy that you could read. And I just want to end, he also said that anarchists will always be in the minority, will always be a small group, and really what we should see ourselves as, people hopefully will all become free and it'll be a wonderful free society, but we shouldn't hope to create an anarchist society. But anarchists should always serve the function of being vigilant custodians of freedom. I love that. Vigilant custodians of freedom. In a sense, we should be an ethical voice constantly. We don't need to take power. We need to just keep putting out sort of ethical notions. Okay, I don't know so much about these, so I'll just go through really fast. Tolstoy actually was of the spiritual school of anarchism, highly, highly influential to pacifist anarchism. His whole premise and others' followers were that looking again at the church as a form of domination, they thought the church was hierarchical and artificial, like states, and that human beings, with capitalism, anarchists thought human beings should be able to self-manage their work and their production and their consumption. Anarchists also thought they should be able to self-manage the political sphere. Spiritualist sort of anarchists thought that humans were capable of being spiritual beings directly, and they are capable of managing their faith, their spiritual selves. Now, this is totally outside the structure of organized religion. I can have a faith. I personally don't. This is why I don't read it. I'm not so interested. I don't feel like I have faith in the way he's understanding it. But I think it's totally cool that people do. But outside of organized religion, in a sense, when it's you trying to determine what your faith is, maybe together with other people. But it's not a hierarchical form of faith. And again, they were often pacifists because of this, because it was very strong, it was sort of faith-based, ethical, and so not all of them, but oftentimes they were pacifists. And this kind of tendency did a lot of nonviolent direct actions, passive resistance, civil disobedience. Really influential tendency within anarchism that doesn't get enough sort of looked at, especially these days. And the last I want to end on, just because I love this guy. And unfortunately, they were mostly guys at this time period, although we could find more people that weren't guys, but it was largely guys, which is another problem at the time. Gustav Landauer, he's only one book translated into English called The Call to Socialism. It's a critique of social democracy and reformist kinds of socialism, and he calls for socialism, but he understood socialism to be anarchism. And the reason I want to call him a communitarian is that he and others believe that had a strong emphasis on volunteerism or the will, that if enough of us felt like society could change, that there is the possibility always for people to remake society voluntarily together. And I think, again, a little naive, because you can't just like, oh, gee, how about tonight at 5 we all meet and just change society because we all think it'd be better. But there was a nice sense of constantly giving people agency, and it's extremely utopian. Again, he was Jewish, and I point to that because he used his religion, like Martin Buber, who I pointed to at the beginning, who had the word anocracy. They were buddies. They both believed in this idea of a sort of a messianic kind of anarchism, where we need to work in this world toward a salvation of the world here on earth. They sort of bring religious ideas down to earth. It's not like there's going to be a Jesus coming or a Messiah, but we need to bring sort of that to the earth. Very utopian. He also believed, he rejected sort of forms of proletarian socialism and economism at the time, which most of these other anarchists didn't. They were very workerist oriented. And he said, no, it's not about workers. It's about all of us together living communally, being directly democratic, working together. One of the really 100 years before most anarchists had ever thought this, he was advocating rural settlements, directly democratic councils, but not just of workers, of intellectuals, of artists, all sorts of other things, really ahead of his time. Not particularly innovative, but ahead of his time. Very utopian. So. Okay, so the common, I just kind of want to point to, so I have all these different schools, they have all sorts of minor tendencies, but the common themes between these thing is that they all understand, again, as I said, anti-capitalist, anti-statist, critique of forms of domination. And they all are riddled with problems because they are thought of in a time period of the 19th century when there was industrial revolution, when there was different forms of social organization, when things like gender, sexuality, sexism, racism, homophobia, all these other things hadn't even really been thought of particularly, or at least not by these people. And suddenly you have, for a host of reasons, anarchism sort of disappearing after the 1930s in Spain when most fascism rises in Europe, anarchists are killed, imprisoned, exiled, drop out all over the world, and anarchism sort of gets lost. Marxism, because of the last century, was really a century of Bolshevism and communism, and really the communist historians, you have communism versus capitalism, but in a sense you end up having polarized history of the story of communism, the story of capitalism. A lot more Marxists were able to write books, and so in a sense the history gets written by the victorious, the leftist historians. Obviously the liberal historians weren't writing about communism, but so anarchism sort of gets written out, and it also sort of disappears in a sense, but reemerges again in the 1950s. And at that point, suddenly the world's very different after the war. After fascism, which is a new invention and a horrible one, as colonial struggles are happening, post-colonial societies emerging, a whole new emphasis on what production looks like. Suddenly there's actually leisure societies and consumer societies. So anarchism has to start rethinking itself. How does it relate to new forms of work, new forms of leisure time, consumer society, new social movements that are emerging, new issues, this again, gender, ecology. We could point to a whole bunch of issues. In 1989, the collapse of communism, etc., and now globalization. So to go back to these classical schools of anarchism might give you an inkling of where you want to go, but it's completely inadequate and problematic if you try to say, oh, gee, I'm going to take Kropotkin and just apply him today. I'm a Kropotkinist. By the way, we should all be living in, small-scale rural settlements of 12 people that blah, 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 blah. It makes no sense to the reality of how our lives are structured, even what we want out of life. Because we want something really different than they. We have different visions and a different idea of the world. So suddenly you have all sorts of new schools emerging, which I'm not going to go into in anarchism right now. Eco-anarchists, ecological anarchists of all different type, anarchists of color, queer, transgendered, transsexed anarchists, cultural anarchists, techie, do-it-yourself anarchists, anarchists emphasizing direct democracy more than anarchists did in the past, autonomous, anti-capitalist, post-structuralist anarchists, academic anarchists, then anarchists I wouldn't even include, people that call themselves anarcho-communists, there's people that call themselves anarcho-nationalists, which are pretty much just right-wing, outright kind of nationalist right-wingers. but there are a host of legitimate types of anarchism emerging today. And I do not have any more time to go into that. But you can understand how, if you go back and look at the history of anarchism, what would mutualism look like today or collectivism look like today? We have different forms of work, different forms of leisure time, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so I want to end with, you have all these schools of anarchism. It's kind of mind-boggling. You have all these new issues coming in, like, oh, my God, I'm an anarchist. What the hell do I share with that anarchist over there and that anarchist over here and that anarchist over there? Because I think a lot of the problem with anarchism is everybody's like, oh, anarchism is whatever you want it to be and la-da-la-da-la. But I think ultimately there's a lot of things that we do sort of share as anarchists, which really define, and we could maybe add some more, and it still continues to be more than ever, new improved capitalism. Anti-capitalism and anti-statism, although both those things will have to look different because the state and capital are both really different, but still connects. You won't meet an anarchist that doesn't really kind of reject both those things. And this is kind of the limits of what keeps you outside of it. That's why I'd say anarcho-capitalists are not on this list. A generalized critique of domination or hierarchy or both. Not just a critique, but a rejection, the desire to abolish. Critique and abolish. And as one friend of mine said, anarchism is about the constant, or a couple friends of mine have talked about anarchism before that I've heard, it's a constant, like this nagging itch, oh, I wonder if that's a new form of domination emerging. Or, you know, that anarchists are always kind of like looking to find those things, and that's a good thing, that we're always in meetings like, hey, you just said this and that really bothered me and stuff. I mean, you can go to the extreme and never get anything done by doing that, but there's something about having that nagging thing in your back of your mind, I wonder if that's a new form of domination emerging. A good thing, I think. And anarchists always feel that way. Okay, not just to focus on economic, but really multidimensional, and that would include political, social, I'm talking about domination and freedom, personal, cultural, understandings of both freedom and unfreedom. I'm not saying that other categories of political philosophy don't do this, but in a totality, these things really define anarchism. That anarchism, in a multidimensional way, tries to understand how freedom works in both these ways and how unfreedom works. I think what's, to me, one of the most beautiful things about anarchism, more than anything else, is that anarchists are always grappling with how to be ethical, which is a real dilemma, because I think there's almost no way to be ethical in this society. You can just do approximations of the best you can do to be ethical. But anarchists are always also, besides kind of like, is that domination, are always asking, am I doing the right thing? Is this a good quality of life? Am I really listening to other people? Am I talking too much, like I'm doing now, blah, blah, blah. But anarchists really try to have a framework where they ask, is that something that's wrong and what is right first before asking, is that possible, is that pragmatic, you know, is that strategic? And I think that's good because almost nobody asks ethical questions anymore. Just kind of assume, well, okay, we can get it done. Maybe we could stop Bush. Maybe we could do this. Isn't the first question I would ask. It's like, what kind of society we want? And then we might decide a whole bunch of things. That's a really nice thing I think about anarchism. It means often an anarchist might just kind of have a nice ethics a lot of time and not might be able to accomplish anything. But maybe that's our role, as Malatesta said, in a sense, to be vigilant, constant custodians of freedom, and that's how through our ethics. Anarchism looks for both liberation and freedom, and by that I mean liberation means freedom from things. I don't want someone to tell me what to do with my body. Okay, that's fine. I don't want someone to tell me I can't have an abortion. But that's not freedom, because what can I do with my body? That's a different question. What can I do with my body? Gee, I wonder if I could, you know, give myself some tattoos, or I wonder if I could learn to do whatever, blah, blah, some extreme sport, which I'm not into. Okay, whatever. But in a way, it's like, what do you want? It isn't just, or what kind of sexuality could I experience, or how could I understand my gender? Anarchism say it's neither one nor the other. If you don't have freedom, freedom from constraints, you have to have the ability to control your body, but for what purpose? And then we start envisioning sorts of wonderful ways that we would like to see our bodies be or act in the world or place in the world, not just bodies, but anything. The other thing anarchists talk about is, in different ways, I'm not using always the same language that everybody uses, is substantive equality. And by that, I mean that we are not all equal. That anarchists, more than anyone, acknowledge that, in fact, we're all pretty much different from each other, but we should be equal in our difference. So that means is we might all like different foods. I mean, food's always one of those, you know, you have to be a vegan, you have to be a vegetarian, you can't eat meat. But to me, the point is, no, people should be able to sort of argue that out. Yes, maybe we decide certain foods aren't part of where we live or our society. We understand you couldn't do them ecologically or humanely. But in a way, what anarchism is saying is not everybody likes to eat the same thing or the same amount or at the same time of day. But how can we equalize the fact that everybody needs food? Everybody deserves food and deserves enough to have enough food so that they can survive, not at the expense of other people. If we're experiencing a drought or a famine, we need to also share in that, I think. But how can we have substantive equality so the differences are just as equally acknowledged? So you don't just take a piece of pie and cut it into equal slices and everybody gets a tiny bit. Maybe I don't like pie and I'm like, fine, someone else can take my piece of pie this time. That's what I mean by substantive equality. And that's really different than just equality, which I think a lot of liberals, or even when we do a lot of justice work, justice is about everyone getting the same thing. But we're not all the same. And so we have to recognize that too. Most anarchists share an understanding that people need things and desire things. Marx came up with the phrase, from each according to their need, to each according to their need. So in other words, I give as much as I can give to work, from each according to my need to work, and then I get back whatever I need to survive. But anarchists said, okay, that's true, but what about desire? From each according to their desire, to each according to their desire. Does that make sense? That in a sense, it isn't just about what you need, but it's also what you want. And if we live in a world, because these things are really malleable. Like I use that example of an SUV. Someone might desire an SUV, and someone might think it's a need, and we might say it's neither, but we need to figure that out together somehow. And that's kind of a bad example, because there's a whole bunch, do we need, is love, I think love's a good example, is love a need or a desire? And I'd argue it's both. So I keep using love as an example. It's because my partner's still in Europe and I'm back here. All right. Anarchist emphasis. There's also an emphasis on spontaneity and playfulness and joy and happiness. And that's what I said at the beginning. I think social revolution isn't just about us all getting enough to survive day to day, but I'm fairly critical of the extremist tendencies of sort of primitivist. I don't like to include primitivism so much under anarchism because I think that's more of extreme individualism, where they're not so concerned that people experience joy at the extreme end of primitivism or happiness, and you don't even know that you're even really going to get enough each day. And I think that's really problematic. Again, I really do. I think people need to know they have enough, but they also need to know why they have enough and enjoy what they have and enjoy the world. And I don't want a revolution where everyone's really unhappy and miserable at the same time, or a better society. Kind of seems humorous, but I mean, the demonstrations for those of us who are older are so much more fun in Seattle and so much more joyful, and that's a part of social change. We have to be happy to make a better society too. Okay, another part is voluntary association, but I say that only in conjunction with mutual aid or cooperation. It isn't just about doing whatever you want at any time, but it's about voluntary association means I should be able to live with who I want to, or love who I want to, or work who I want to. But once I sort of make those commitments, I need to also kind of pull my share of the weight, as long as I'm in that relationship and have committed to things. And maybe I'm part of a collective and it doesn't go well on our meeting on Tuesday, and every time it doesn't go well on the meeting on Tuesday, I don't say, that's it, I'm not voluntarily associating with you, and walk out every week. Maybe after 6 months where every week it's like horrible, then I walk out, but I've made maybe a commitment to a project for a certain time. I've voluntarily agreed to work with people on a project we're going to work to together, and there's some kind of balance between these two. And what the balance is, each of us needs to figure out for ourselves. I'm not suggesting you should voluntarily agree to be with people and stay with them for the rest of your lives just because you feel a sense of mutual aid, but there's a balance between those two within a lot of anarchist thought. Okay, and the last couple things before I wrap up within anarchism, and then what number am I on? Is anarchists tend to look toward decentralism and simultaneously interdependence, or local and simultaneously global, or self and society. It's that same thing I talked about at the beginning, the balance between a free society of free individuals. Anarchists are always trying to say, it's neither one nor the other, it's how do we do both together? And how do we balance the things? Because there's good parts about the global that I think we would all like right now in terms of like global days of action. We like that. We like knowing that there's anti-capitalists and revolutionaries in other parts of the world. We like learning from movements around the world. But that's not where we live. We live somewhere local, and we want to retain our identity at the local level. So there's some kind of balance between the two. We want to do our own actions, have autonomy to do that. Anarchists are often utopian or visionary. More than any other political philosophy, what's best about anarchism, again, is not just that it's a constant critique. And almost, I've been reading a lot of Marxist social theory lately, contemporary Marx, and they're all like, well, Marxism is great for critique of society, but, and then they start almost saying anarchism. They're like, but if you want a vision of society, but they can't quite say it. But they're like, you really need to look to other political traditions. And I'm like, okay, what are they talking about? That anarchist has really been utopian or visionary and has really tried to say there isn't some magical moment where we jump on the barricades and the world's a better place and then we'd get off and everything's fine forever. That it's constantly about now trying to do the best we can to make the world look utopian and good. And that means doing right now what we think we want the world to look like later. That is so fundamental to every anarchist. They try as hard as they can in every little area, their personal life, their work life, their pleasure life, their project life, etc., to make everything as visionary and utopian as possible. That's a wonderful, beautiful thing, I think, about anarchism right now. And then other people can say, wow, I always use this example, my dad, I've structured my life, I work, I edit books for a living, and they come. That's where I can live wherever I want to, because FedEx, they follow me, I'm part of flexible capitalism. But I have tons of free time that I can donate to projects, because I don't have a trust fund, and so I make money in my 2 hours a day, and then I spend the rest of the day, but I have lots of leisure time, I can do those. And my dad's like, I wish I could have done that. And I was like, I always go, but you could have in a way, you know. And in a way, what you want to do is provide examples of ways it's possible. Now, of course, not to romanticize what I do, I'm completely bound up with global flexible capitalism. I am the epitome of part-time, temporary, blah, 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 global capitalism, running around, working in Amsterdam, coming back here, got a book with me right now. So I'm not romanticizing that, oh, wow, I'm so free, I'm overcome, blah, blah, blah. But at least different people in our own individual ways, we try to, how can I give myself enough time away from work, my wage labor, to donate to projects that I care about. And I hope that all of us can look to other people and say, wow, I wish I lived like that, and then we could say, but you could maybe, and help them see that they could. Okay, and the last thing I want to say within anarchism, I think almost all anarchists share, is forms of self-organization, which is what I started with. Okay, so I started this very talk saying anarchism is order, a different form of social order, one without the absence of domination that has an emphasis on freedom. So anarchism, more than anything, is trying to figure out what those forms of social organization would be. Do-it-yourself, direct action, self-management, self-government, direct democracy, any way we can, every decision, everything that impacts our lives, how do we make those decisions together? How do we work that together? So anarchists are constantly trying to figure out what different forms of self-organization, and I mean this in a social way. I do not mean how does Cindy organize her sock drawer. I mean, how do we together organize society in a different way? And so then anarchism, I think, at the best, at its best, provides really an ethical orientation or a compass to understand what's wrong with the world today by critiquing it. But that's only in order to root out new forms of hierarchy and domination, in order to continually to struggle for these new forms of social organization right now and how we organize. And I think what we do really badly, in a sense, is we do great forms of social organization, and we often forget to emphasize those. We emphasize, oh, look, we shut down this, or we didn't shut down that, or, you know, we broke a window, or we did this, or all these things we do that are great here and there, blah, blah, blah. But we forget to say, oh, but here's how we organize a demonstration, or here's how. And my favorite, one of my examples that I probably used before is during the RNC in Philly 3 years ago. There was spokes council every night, directly democratic, and I'm like, here, we're contesting how decisions are made, and we're coming, and, you know, there's these people at the door, the whole security culture, they're like, who are you? If you can't come into the spokes council unless you're this, and you can't come in if you're that. And it was very secretive about this. I mean, certainly most of us got into the spokes council. But I'm like, this is insane. This is exactly what we want the world to be looking like of these kind of decision-making bodies, but we're scared to show them in public, whatever the public is, that isn't okay to come through the door. And I think that's a big mistake. Like, is the demonstration that happened in Philly important, or is it how we got to that demonstration? And we were so secretive about it, it made no sense to me. From a sort of anarchistic perspective, that was the core of what we were doing. And so I want to just end on, I think that the last century was sort of a century of sort of communism being really dominant, as we had the worst of what communism, Marxism, communism with an uppercase C, and now in a sense I think this is the anarchist century, and I think that's sort of being made possible by globalization, sad to say, capitalist globalization and state globalization, but to some degree what it says is suddenly we're coming to a world where it really is more a world without borders, and it is really a flexible world, and we are able to have sort of networks of mutual aid and voluntary association across borders, and there is a global sense of solidarity for the first time in human history, even if it's a solidarity between the global elites or a solidarity between autonomous movements. But things anarchists have called for, capitalists are doing now, and states are doing now. But on the other hand, what's good about that is that shows people that it's possible. If capitalists can have global networks of solidarity with each other and communicate and get something done, gee, maybe we could do the same thing and not do it in a capitalist mode. It is possible. Because one of the biggest arguments you hear against anarchism is, that's all nice and good, but we live in a complicated world. How the hell would you get X to here or Y to there or make these decisions about AIDS or global warming or blah, blah, blah? But it's globalization under capitalism is showing that it is possible to coordinate the most amazing things on the global level, amazingly horrible, things on the global level, but it shows that the things that anarchists have long been talking about in methodology are possible. Now the point is to bring in all these other things. Okay, but ethically, how do we want to do that? And without domination, how do we want to do that? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But maybe this will be the century where we can start to begin to really see how the ways we've been talking about social organization could be decapitalized and de-stateized, de-dominationized. And so in a way, I think this is some of the most exciting time to be alive if you're an anti-authoritarian.
This has been a recording of Cindy Milstein presenting Anarchism 101. She spoke at the National Conference on Organized Resistance at American University in Washington, D.C. on January 24, 2004. Thanks for listening.
And thanks to George King for that recording. We'd love to hear from you, and if you'd like to contact the program, you can email us unwelcome@radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral, 4ALL.net. Or visit our website at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.
By unwelcome travelers, another brave